Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Imagine waking up in the morning and realizing you can't open your mouth because you couldn't afford to treat a niggling problem before it turned into a medical emergency. That's what happened to one woman you'll meet in the next 20 minutes. She's one of an estimated 2 million Australians who've been putting off going to the dentist. Dentists are calling for change in Canberra today. Well, they're actually calling for a national oral health plan that's now 2 years overdue. Also ahead, when did you have the chat with your partner? Not the sex chat, not the should we have kids chat, the big one, the money chat. How to have that conversation well is coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, it's the night that nerds around the nation look forward to, and it only comes around once in a quinquennium. That's every 5 years. Yes, it's me. I'm nerds. The Australian Census is upon us. Among the questions that statisticians will be keenly poring over is a fairly simple one. What is the person's religion? We've seen huge shifts in Australia's religious makeup since the census began more than 100 years ago. And in 2021, Christianity was the most common response, but it had dropped by a million since 2016. This was followed by people ticking no religion. Islam was the next most popular religion, then Hinduism, then Buddhism. But answering this question isn't always straightforward. Do you say you're Catholic if you only go to church once a year for the hymns? Do you write Judaism if you're non-practicing but feel culturally Jewish? I'm about to dive into what our answers to this question really say about us with a former Catholic and an ex-Muslim atheist. But I would love to hear from you, particularly if your religious identity has changed over time. Do you still feel connected to a faith that you don't practice? With me is Rebecca Huntley, one of Australia's most foremost researchers on social trends and the director of research at 89 Degrees East, and Sammy Shah, journalist, comedian and author who, for today's purposes, is ticking the atheist box. Rebecca, Sammy, welcome.
Hello.
Thanks so much for having us.
Rebecca, I might start with you. How are you going to answer this question about religion tonight?
Well, the same way I answered the last time, which is no religion.
Mm-hmm. But that's changed over your lifetime.
It has. I think, you know, I'm 54 now, so I've seen a few censuses in my time. I don't actually know what the plural
is. I actually looked it up before. It is censuses. Don't worry.
Is it?
I looked it
it's
up
not
in the
censi.
No, it's not.
Thank
Macquarie
you.
Dictionary says
that.
Censuses. Keep going, please.
So it was Catholic for a long time, largely not necessarily because I was a practicing Catholic, but it was the church that I had the most exposure to. And it was also the religion of my grandmother on my mother's side is Italian, and I suppose the one that I was closest to. So best expression of my sense of being really an Italian Australian rather than a Catholic Australian.
So very much a cultural identity more than a religious identity.
Exactly.
Sammy, how about yourself?
I've been here since 2012, so a few sense of odai myself. And I think that's the plural I'm going with.
Okay.
I'm quite confident I've always ticked no religion. As you described me and it's a very accurate description, I see myself as an atheist who might be culturally Muslim in terms of, you know, I have the cultural practices like, you know, celebrating the big holidays and such that are ingrained always. But beyond that, I don't identify myself as a religious person. So I just felt that's an accurate description.
What does it mean to you to be culturally Muslim, Sammy?
It's interesting because that's changed over time. It was much stronger when I first moved here. And in my first few years in Australia, you know, I just come from Pakistan. And there's a lot of like, you know, saying Bismillah, Mashallah, and other invocations to Allah whenever something happens in your life. And there's a certain level of karma that you still believe in, mm-hmm. which I think any religious person or ex-religious person can never really shake loose. So there, those
we call it guilt in Catholicism.
There, exactly, yeah. It's just a different wording, same effect. And, so all of that was there quite strongly. But since moving to Melbourne particularly, I mean, I spent my first 4 years in a country town in WA as well. My communications and integration with the Muslim community in Australia is quite minimal. And so as a result, I feel less and less of even that, I suppose. It's a huge part of my identity, but I see it as part of being Pakistani, like a Pakistani-Australian, because Pakistan is obviously a Muslim country, more than just being a, you know, person who sees themselves, considers themselves a Muslim. And, yeah.
Rebecca, I'm really curious about this sense of, Sammy talked about karma, you talked about Catholic guilt, the way that the superstitions or the kind of taboos associated with the religion stick around long after the rest of the belief system does?
They certainly do, but I think it's that part of the complex mix of what you grow up with, of your inheritance in some sense, and then that changes over time, depending on really your own development, your own psychological, moral development, but also your behaviour. So for me, the reason why in the last census I picked no religion for the first time is I'd been a researcher for a while and, you know, in order to understand whether somebody is, you know, religious, not really religious, but religious, that there's multi-layers to that religious identity, in our normal research, we often have to ask between 7 to 9 questions. It's not just like, are you Christian or not? Are you Muslim or not? To really understand. And for me, I kind of thought, well, I'm not a fan of the Catholic Church in some ways, some of the things that it's done. I don't go to church. I don't believe in a God. And so it seemed kind of disingenuous. It lacked integrity to call myself Catholic. And I suppose the other thing that happened, and this does happen, is that sometimes you have politicians and some religious leaders, not all religious leaders, who kind of say that they speak for all the faith when they speak out about particular issues. Mm. So we saw that during the same-sex marriage debate about people saying, you know, we speaking for a particular religious group, of whether they support it or not. That was obviously not always the case, right? Because you can even be somebody that calls yourself, really does engage with your religious community beyond going to a wedding or, you know, going every now and then. You could be a really important part of the church, but you may not necessarily agree with church leaders. So for me, I just thought there's not a lot of integrity in terms of me calling myself Catholic, like in terms of behaviour and thinking. And so time to be no religion.
Mm. You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with social trends researcher Rebecca Huntley and comedian, author and journalist Sammy Shah. I'm talking about the census and what that question about what is the person's religion, what that actually tells us about our religious beliefs in Australia. And I'm asking how you're approaching that question tonight, particularly if your religious identity has changed over time. Maybe you still feel connected to a faith you don't practice. Vivian, you're not quite sure how to answer this question. Why is that?
Sorry, I missed that last bit.
Tell me what's going through your mind as you approach the religion question, Vivian.
Yeah, look, I practice meditation, so I consider that a part of a spirituality, which I see as different to religion. So I really don't know what I'm going to write for that. So I see spirituality as practices that help us to become closer to, you know, what some people might call God or, you know, the higher self, you know, which is what people who are religious do, but it's without kind of a set dogma, I suppose.
That's a really good point, Vivian. Rebecca, what are our options when we approach that question?
Well, none really. And I suppose we have to think about the limitations of the census in many ways. The census is not great at nuance. So, I mean, a lot of things will be, in the same way that a lot of different kinds of people will be captured in Christianity or any of the other religious options on the table in terms of a broad spectrum of belief and behaviour. No religion is increasingly a really interesting category and can include people who feel in many ways cultural, a strong cultural attachment to their family's religion but don't want to put it there, to people who are highly spiritual and there's no option, which means that the census is just, it raises as many questions as it answers. It's critically important because unless we don't know how we're changing, we can't make plans for today and the future. But, you know, to Vivian's point, when in the social research that I do at 89 Degrees East, we are asking like lots of questions to understand how people feel about established religion, but also how they feel about spirituality, and including, you know, Vivian talked about meditation. We also talk to people whose commitment to the environment is incredibly important to them and a kind of form of spirituality. And so that's why we have social research between the 5 years of the census to be able to unpack all this.
Why do we care about religion? You say it's good for planning. What sorts of things are we planning?
Well, I mean, once upon a time, religion would have been extraordinarily important, you know, again, to understand who Australia is. I mean, I'm interested in all the other questions that you would have in the census. There are very obvious planning implications from that in terms of how we plan our economy, how we plan our cities, how we plan healthcare, education and so forth. It's interesting to see whether religion is something, and I wouldn't know because I'm not a politician or a bureaucrat, whether those kinds of things are really playing into the kinds of decisions about, you know, whether particular kinds of religious infrastructures or churches need to be built in some areas or not. I'm not sure what it does, if it has the same kinds of implications as other kinds of questions in the census. I think we will know, you know, it will be very interesting the moment that no religion overtakes established religion, if that happens in this census or the next one. That's where the trend is going, and what that might mean for our politics and for our decision making. I'm really interested to see what happens.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You're calling me today to tell me how you're approaching this question on the census tonight about religion. Nicola, your family have some differences in how they answer this question.
Yeah, I sent a text to our family chat last night because I was completing a census with my partner. And I asked, we're Jewish, I guess. And I asked my family who was recording their religion as Jewish, because obviously if you're practicing, that's a clear answer. But I'm not practicing, no one in my family practices. So we had split opinions on what should we record ourselves as. I think it's important to capture our heritage and our race, but heritage wasn't a question, race wasn't a question, but ancestry was a question. So I didn't actually record it under ancestry either. So, but my sister will be recording her religion as Judaism. So there you go. But my mum won't.
Do you feel like maybe it's missing that data point about you then, because there wasn't a place that felt appropriate to put it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think in like the current context, obviously, with the with everything that's happening in Australia and obviously in the Middle East, it's important to capture people's race, and so that we know, like I guess I'd identify myself, not right now obviously because I'm speaking in a public forum, but as one of the silent Jews that kind of just sits there under the radar. Like I don't practice, I don't go to synagogue, I don't even know when the holidays are, but if there was a Holocaust, I'd probably be in a concentration camp today, you know? So like it's in my bloodline. So I think that's important to record somehow, but that's obviously not something that can be recorded in this census.
Nicola, such interesting points you raise. Sammy, your household in a similar way has a couple of different answers to this question on the census. Tell me about how religion looks for the rest of your family.
Well, yeah, my partner is Jewish, and so she has listed herself as Jewish, and our two kids together were raised Jewish, are being raised Jewish, and so they're, you know, they're being listed the same way. My oldest daughter, who's from my former partner, you know, she's like her father and pretty much like her mother, is non-religious. So for her, we've, you know, listed her as that, and so there is that variety there. But there, you know, what the caller just said raised a really important point. I remember after the Christchurch attack in 2019, and the mosque over there, and the Muslim community in Australia kind of felt a bit under siege at the time. The 2021 census, I believe it was. There's a lot of, you know, community messaging going around saying, you know, even if you're not a practicing Muslim or you're not very aggressively Muslim, please make sure you list yourself as Muslim so the community, so the country sees our presence. And I know for a fact that the Jewish communities are trying to kind of have a similar message out right now, because it's very important for them to be seen, to have their numbers recorded. And so even if you're not a practicing Jew or you know, let's say you're someone who's maybe lapsed or whatever, you still list yourself as such so that the numbers reflect the size of the community overall. And the Muslim community is very much probably saying the same thing right now as well. So there is in these communities this need to not just represent the individual, but also send a message which is almost, I would describe, as political. Mm. I'd be quite surprised if, I think very largely, if I can make an uneducated guess, that the census result would probably see a rise in non-religious again, a further drop in Christianity as a religious belief. But you might see a rise in Islam, because more Muslims will list themselves. Might see a rise in Judaism under other, because it's not currently listed as its own category. And you probably see Hinduism seeing a massive rise because of how many more migrants are now coming from India. And so that will then become an interesting mix in the next census from now, when people want their communities to be represented better and listed more obviously. So yeah, some of these messages are unique to the communities, and they're interesting to me because they then show that it's not just about the individual. It's not just about you sitting alone on your computer ticking. It's also what you want that tick to represent for the wider community you may feel part of.
It's so interesting, Sammy, and I think we might need to get you back when the data is released to see if your predictions bear out. There might be like a Fredo Frog in it or something for you. A couple of texts coming through. A few people asking about Judaism. We've been talking about it. Why isn't it on the religion question? It's not been removed as an option from the census form. It's never been a pre-filled response option on the census religion question. This is from the ABS website. Judaism has been included as an example in the instructional text since examples were introduced in 2001. So the question, what is the person's religion, allows a person to choose a response from a tick-the-box options or to write their religion in a free text field. Ticks box options in the 2026 census are based on the most common mutually exclusive responses from 2021. These options are no religion, Catholic, Anglican, Church of England, Islam, Hinduism, Uniting Church, Presbyterian, Buddhism, Greek Orthodox, and Baptist. So that's maybe answering your question if you're not sure why your religion isn't listed. You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. We're talking about the census. We're talking about Australia's religious beliefs and how you answer that question on the census about your religion. If you maybe grew up in a religion that you don't identify with anymore, maybe you've converted over your lifetime, I'd love to know what's going through your mind as you approach that question tonight. And here with me talking about it is social trends researcher Rebecca Huntley and comedian, author and journalist Sammy Shah. Dennis, you've called in. You think the answer is a bit more complicated than what you can fit into a form. Can you talk me through what you're thinking about as you approach this question?
Well, g'day, Keegan. Lovely to talk to you. Look, it's when you do a census, people should be very mindful of the fact that the information we're giving is very, very important, not only to people who are reading it, but to the people who are actually filling out the census. And my opinion is, it's only my opinion, of course, that the labels tend to recategorize people into the field of that's what you are. But in my opinion, I'm a person of faith, even though I worship in a church. I don't want to particularly be labeled to a church. I'm rather labeled to God. Now, I know this sounds all very sanctimonious, but trust me, it isn't, because I've never been a person who's never found the fact that faith is something that has survived me, the loss of my wife, the fact that I'm partially blind. There's other things that have happened in my life, and without faith, that has not been, there would be no answer to these issues that we face day by day. Why is the world going through all this? And it seems to me, just by pinpointing and saying, well, I'm a Jew or I'm an Islam, or I'm whatever, it's too broad. And to my way of thinking, I want to individualise it by saying, I'm a man of faith because that's what I practice day by day in my life.
Dennis, thank you so much. That's a great insight. Rebecca, do we need to rethink how we ask this question for it to be useful information?
Well, look, between the census and in the after the census happens and we then get the wave of different kinds of data over a period of time, there's always a review. And there's been real examples of where the community have come together to say, look, there's something about this census question that doesn't really adequately even begin to measure what needs to be measured. And this may be a question certainly to the point of, for example, perhaps listing Judaism as a discrete category and on par with some of those other categories that that might happen. So there is an opportunity for the community and for, you know, of all, you know, for all in all different ways to get involved in how the census gets structured. Now, there are limitations, and I was sorry I interrupted you, Tegan, before, because that answer that the ABS gave about why Judaism isn't called out is a very typical researcher answer, a very different method, technical methodological response. But, I mean, I think the people calling in are reflecting something that's really important and is how people should approach the census. Obviously take it seriously, but you are speaking about how you yourself feel, and as Sammy made a point as well, potentially making a statement about what kind of society we want Australia to be and who gets counted. So we're almost thinking about it as an individual, personal, but also at a collective level. And it may be that some people, exactly the same kinds of people, some might tick an official religion and some might not for their own personal reasons. And that's not a bad thing.
I'm really enjoying also seeing your texts coming through on the text line, hearing your voices telling me this morning about how you're approaching this. So many people very, very thoughtful about this. Nina says, at the last census, I said no religion. But as an Italian migrant from Sicily, who's just come back from a big trip visiting Italy and particularly Sicily and spent time with my strong Catholic cousins, this time I think I will revert to being Catholic. But I'm not a great fan of religions, so I'm a bit perplexed. Erica also says, I was brought up a Catholic and am grateful for the morals I learned and to be a caring member of society. However, in my early 20s, I realised I didn't even believe in God, so calling myself a member of any religion was an oxymoron. And Patricia, you've called in. This is the first census where you're going to be ticking a new box. Tell me your story.
Oh, yes. Churches are organisations, as well as being a very personal commitment. And I've had a personal commitment to God and Jesus, I guess, but I'm not an evangelical. This time I've moved, and I'm a Lutheran, and they had to tell us at church how to say that because it's not one of the main religions. And I'm a fairly new Lutheran from having been an Anglican all my life. So that's quite a quirky thing. But what impresses me about my local group is they're very supportive. But they also agree with the ordination of women, and they make collective decisions in the local group. And that democratisation of the church is really important to me. I don't want to be obeying male bishops any longer.
Patricia, thank you so much for the call. Sammy, for people who might have distanced themselves from a religion that they were previously affiliated with, what do you think is going through their minds as they're answering this question?
I think the challenge for them is the definition of the word religion there. Because for many people, you know, when you click no religion, it seems to imply you're an atheist. You know, so when I click that, that's exactly what I want it to mean. But for many others, it's not. For many others, it is, I do not any longer practice a set of rituals and a dogma or to adhere to the teachings of a certain prescribed text. However, I still have a relationship with God. I still have a relationship with spirituality, which, you know, so many of the callers have now reiterated. I think that's the complexity there, in that they're seeing religion as meaning, you know, connection to God, whereas I think the census, if I understand it correctly, is more implying which of these, you know, generally understood, generalized descriptions of, you know, major practices do you adhere to? And so the no religion thing doesn't necessarily mean you're an atheist. It just means you're not a subscriber to this, you know, streaming network of religious dogma.
Yeah.
So I think that's basically where the confusion is coming from. But and so maybe in future, it might be, you know, behoove the census takers to add another category of spiritual or something vague like that. But I think that'll be an interesting change if it happens. I think the big change, you know, right now might be that in the next census in 2031, you might see one or two more minority religions that, you know, like Judaism, maybe even Jainism, get enough numbers to be represented outside of a drop-down list. Mm. Let's see what happens.
Well, Jennifer, you've called in. Your answer to this census question has changed, but in a different direction to most of who we've spoken to today.
Yeah, I was, as the previous person said, streaming to a different service last time I filled out a census. So I would have selected something that described me as not having faith or an atheist. I've become a Christian since, and I also have very close friends who are Muslim, and I feel like it's important for us in this political climate to make sure that we're capturing everyone's religious faith so that the community can be aware of what faiths are in the majority in Australia, and so we can support all faiths in our multicultural society.
Well, Jennifer, thanks so much for the call. Rebecca, briefly, because we are pretty much out of time, what do you hope people bring, what sort of spirit do you hope people bring to filling out their census tonight?
Honesty, civic duty, I think very important. And, you know, if anybody's paying real attention to the census, the emerging story of the census is one of strength in diversity. You know, we hear a lot about diversity being problematic, difficult or whatever from some people, but there is strength in diversity. So if you have people who are going from one category to the other over time, you know, we are in a, that's all part of the picture that the census will paint. We're a diverse society. We always have been. We're stronger doing that. And the census, whatever we get on this religion question, I know that the census will show that when the data comes out next year.
Well, Rebecca, Sammy, thank you both so much for chatting with me today. Rebecca Huntley, Social Trends Researcher and Director of Research at 89 Degrees East. Sammy Shah, journalist, comedian and author of several books, including The Islamic Republic of Australia, based on a documentary series he did with Conversations on Radio National, which you can find on ABC Listen. I'll pop a link in the show notes so you can have a listen to that. And thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and stories with me on this too. One person says, a thought for refugees who ran from governments who persecuted them for race or religion, now being asked to confirm those details and their address with our government. Janine says, I ticked atheist and now regret that I didn't tick other and fill the box with Jewish atheist to reflect my culture and religious beliefs. Well, it is Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, open up and say, nah. We're putting off dental treatment because of cost, and there's currently no national plan to fix it. When was the last time you went to the dentist? If it's been a while, you're not alone. The Australian Dental Association says more than 2 million Australians have skipped dental care due to affordability. And if you're in a regional or remote area, just accessing a dentist can be challenging. Today, 40 dentists from across Australia are at Parliament House in Canberra, raising those issues and calling on the government to release its National Oral Health Plan, which is 2 years overdue. But before we hear more about that, I'd love to hear from you. Have you put off seeing a dentist because of the cost? What has that meant for your health? With me is Emily Novo, one of the 2 million Australians who's been putting off a trip to the dentist. Emily, welcome to Life Matters.
Morning, Tegan. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? You've had a couple of problems the last few weeks.
Definitely.
Tell me your story.
So
I unfortunately am one of those people who have been putting off the dentist. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was, you know, just a regular day brushing my teeth, felt a bit of tenderness in my gum, sort of just sitting above my wisdom teeth that I still have in, and didn't think much of it. Nothing I haven't sort of experienced before, nothing too common. But little did I know, I woke up the next morning and I couldn't open my mouth. Even open it wide enough to brush my teeth. Couldn't eat a piece of toast, and panic definitely started to set in.
Oh my gosh. So what did you do?
Panic. I was working at the time, so instantly sort of gave my boss a call and said, I'm absolutely not coming to the office today. Just need to sort of figure myself out and buy myself a bit of time. And unfortunately, I am one of those Australians who just, I don't see a regular dentist at all. And since I moved out of home, it's always been on my to-do list, but I am so guilty of just knowing that I just don't have a regular dentist anymore. So when I was having this issue, I spent essentially all morning just hours dwelling on myself in absolute panic, just wondering, do I go to a dentist or do I see my GP? I was in absolute denial, and because I couldn't open my mouth and really have a good look, I just sat there and just pondered, is it a dental issue? Is it a tissue issue? What if I go to the dentist and I was wrong and it's not necessarily a dental issue, then I'm out of pocket hundreds of dollars, and that's not really that kind of spare pocket money that I have at the moment.
So you went to your GP, they sent you to the emergency department. What did they find?
Oh, exactly that. Because I couldn't open my mouth sort of wide enough, the GP just really wasn't confident in sort of giving me any sort of treatment plan. So they immediately referred me to ED. So wasn't too fun going on my lunch break and then suddenly being admitted to hospital. When I went to the ED department, essentially, they, just because of my age, very luckily, they didn't necessarily want me to get any sort of scans, and I didn't have sort of a serious face swelling, I suppose. But I definitely, I've since found out that I had just gotten some bacteria sort of sitting within that cavity between my gum tissue and my wisdom teeth, which just developed a massive abscess, which is why I couldn't open my mouth, and got sent home with some hardcore antibiotics.
So this has been obviously a very painful and scary ordeal for you. Are you out of pocket because of it?
Thankfully not. Not in that sort of aspect, because I was, you know, able to see my GP, went to the ED. There was no out-of-pocket costs there for me except for the sort of little gap just to see my sort of my GP, but absolutely not as much as it would have been if I decided to go to the dentist.
Well, also here with us is Dr. Chris Sanzaro, President of the Australian Dental Association. Chris, listening to Emily's story, how familiar is that to you?
Yeah, that's a very common story that we hear, especially when people turn 18, move out of home, change locations, get their own jobs, and often lose the relationship with the dentist that they've been with for their school time if they've been going through the public dental service for school things. And it doesn't occur to people to say, hey, look, I should go to the dentist just to find out if anything is going wrong. And most dental things exist in the background. Dental disease progresses quietly and silently in the background until it's sort of late stage, and all of a sudden we become aware of something pops up, some significant pain, and dentistry all of a sudden comes into our mind. So it's a very common story, unfortunately.
So is that the main thing that's stopping people from accessing care, this the cost?
Yeah, cost is certainly a big factor. Whenever we survey Australians, we know that's a significant barrier to accessing care. Anyone who's eligible for public funded dentistry often waits significant waiting periods, well longer than you should be waiting to get your teeth checked. And that also acts as a disincentive to act proactively on things. So waiting until there's an emergency, you can get in a lot quicker in those public dental systems because of the way that they're funded.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Chris Sanzaro, President of the Australian Dental Association, and Emily Novo, who ended up in hospital because she delayed dental treatment that sort of left her with an abscess. We're talking about dentistry today because today 40 dentists from across Australia are at Parliament House. They're raising issues with affordability and access for dentistry. They're calling on the government to release its National Oral Health Plan, which is 2 years overdue. And I'm interested to know from you if this resonates. Have you put off seeing a dentist because of the cost? Has that had an impact on your health? One person says, I can afford the dentist, but I don't go because of phobia from the 1960s. Something has to break for me to go. Sue in Hobart says, most Hobart dentists where I've lived for the last 3 years have closed their books. So Chris, it sounds like there are a couple of different drivers here while people are maybe delaying treatment.
Absolutely. And that one with Hobart, we know there's a significant maldistribution of dentists around the country. The large metropolises of Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane are flush with dentists. It's very easy to get appointments and there's a lot of dentists there with less work to do than they need. And as soon as we get out into the regional and remote areas, and in particular Western Australia, outside of Perth, there's a huge shortage of dental workforce in those areas. And so maldistribution is one of the reasons why we're calling on the government to implement the National Oral Health Plan.
So you're in Parliament, you're in Canberra, you're going to Parliament House, you're asking for the government to release this plan. What do you want it to cover?
We wanted to cover improved access for people who can't afford access to dental care at the moment, rolling out similar schemes to what exists for the Children Dental Benefits Schedule into other age groups, essentially means-tested schemes that allow people to access dental care funded through their Medicare card. And that can be the Senior Dental Benefits Schedule is a great example of one that's been called for through multiple Senate inquiries and the Royal Commission into Aged Care. But any age group that we roll that out into, if it was the 18 to 25-year-old, there'd be a significant improvement in access to dental care. We need to focus on the prevention side of things, implementing a sugar-sweetened beverages levy or tax to get manufacturers to reformulate those drinks so they've got less sugar in them and cause less damage to people's teeth. That's going to do a huge amount to improving prevention of dental problems. And then solving that maldistribution issue, getting dentists into the right places around the country so people can actually access care.
That's a lot of heavy lifting for one document to do. What sort of follows from that once it's released?
Yeah, look, the Australian Dental Association is very keen to work with government on the practical implementation of that document. The idea of having a plan is we acknowledge what the problems are. Everyone knows what the problems are. We've already spoken in Parliament House this morning and the politicians have heard us. We've heard lots of them repeat the same messages. Yes, we can see these issues. Yes, we can see those problems. The plan says, well, we need to address those. And then the implementation of that, and the Dental Association is very keen to work with the government on the practical steps for that. And that includes increasing funding to areas of dentistry.
We actually also wrote to the Health Minister, Mark Butler, to ask for an update. In a statement, his department said, the Commonwealth is working closely with states and territories to develop a new national oral health plan for the next decade. The government continues to support around 2.5 million children from low-income families to access basic dental services through the Child Dental Benefits Schedule and contributes to hospital-based dental treatment through the National Health Reform Agreement. I'll put the full statement on the website. So, Chris, it's not like there's nothing happening at the moment.
No, look, it has stalled. That same plan has been there since 2024, and we've been promised this morning by the Assistant Minister that it should be out this year. There were some caveats in the speech that she delivered to us, but it's 2 years overdue, and by the time it gets out, it needs action to implement that as well.
You're telling me your stories as well. One person said, I hadn't been to the dentist for 6 years until the job seeker payments increased during COVID. My housemate, 35 years old, who has a disability and can't work full time, hadn't been to the dentist since the free school dental van. He spent years on the public dental waiting list and then got 5 fillings. Another says, I could never afford dental treatment except having a pension. I'm now eligible for treatment at the Royal Dental Hospital of Melbourne. I'm treated by supervised students and it's great. So Chris, with these programs, people are often, sounds like they're coming to them quite late.
Yeah, that's often the case, especially when there are regions of Australia that have got waiting lists of 3 or 4 years. Now, if you know you've started to get a dental problem, waiting 3 or 4 years until you get in the door, we know those problems are going to get worse over that time, and that's an unacceptably long period for people to be waiting. That's caused by inadequate funding of our public dental services.
So, Chris, I'm getting a lot of questions about Medicare and whether dental should be part of Medicare. I'm almost loath to ask the question because I'm pretty sure I know what your answer would be.
Yeah, look, using the Medicare card to access funding like it does through the Child Dental Benefits Schedule, the ADA's plan is to roll that out rather than replacing entirely this current system that we have, working bit by bit on the areas of the community that have the highest level of need, usually the greatest health burden, as well as the implications that poor dental health can have on their health.
So, Emily, what would it take to get you back in the dentist chair more regularly?
Exactly what Chris has said. If, you know, it was covered under Medicare or there was, you know, a little bit of a gap like I pay with my GP, that definitely will get me back in the chair of a dentist.
Well, Chris, Emily, thank you both so much for joining me today. Dr. Chris Sanzaro is the president of the Australian Dental Association. Emily Novo ended up in hospital because of an untreated abscess. Chris is one of 40-ish dentists in Parliament House in Canberra today, asking for the government to release its national oral health plan 2 years after it was due to be released originally. You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, you take your partner in sickness and in health. But what do you do if you're not on the same page about money? Are you the partner who counts every cent, looks for the discounts, tracks your spending, or are you the one who blithely benefits from it? Or do you feel guilty about spending money you made because you know your partner would disapprove, even if it makes you happy and you can afford it? In this rolling cost of living crisis we find ourselves in, there've never been more arguments to have over how your household should or shouldn't spend your cash. It's a sensitive topic. If you aren't on the same page about money, it can be quite hard to overcome. But never fear, our resident psychologist is here to help you navigate these tricky conversations. And I'd love to hear from you too. If you have differing opinions about money with your partner, how have you managed to overcome your differences? Here with me is Christine Bagley-Jones, our resident psychologist. She joins me fortnightly for Head and Heart. Christine, welcome.
Hello, Tegan.
Has this ever happened to you? Have you had to navigate a spending gap in a relationship before?
Look, maybe years ago, but I've been quite fortunate in that my husband and I have a weird alignment regarding spending, but it's not lost on me that that's quite rare, and we've bypassed a really significant challenge in the relationship.
Did you kind of screen for that? Is that one of the reasons why you're together, is because you are well matched here?
Well, maybe incidentally, but I didn't go out thinking that way, but I was very relieved when I understood that his habits were quite aligned with mine and our values around spending were quite similar. So we haven't had major glitches, but even the small ones over the years, you know, the exorbitant Bunnings receipt that I might see, reminds me of how hard it must be for some couples where there's a huge discrepancy in their relationship with money.
So is this something that crops up a lot with your clients?
Most definitely. I'd have to say it'd be in the top five reasons why either people come for counselling or during the course of our time together, it will come up as an issue.
How does this problem manifest? What does it sound like?
Well, firstly, I think we need to move away from the idea that money is just, you know, dollars that we purchase things with. It's much more complex than that. Our relationship with money starts from our family of origin, where we're witnessing within our home how our parents spend their money. And then we develop beliefs around it, and our value system often follows either that line of money's for spending, for pleasure, for joy, and life's for living, versus those that think about security and wanting the safety of knowing that their bills are paid, that they're spending in a way that doesn't lead to unnecessary debt.
And also the things you value differ between people. The things you want to spend your money on differ.
That's the other thing. We make judgments around how someone's spending their money. So it's not just the actual figure, but it's like whether it's perceived as waste. Like, for example, those people that really treasure having a nice lunch at work as a reward for their hard, you know, day at the office might be perceived as frivolous when they could bring their own lunch. So when we start making value judgments around how our partner spends money, that just doubles down on the conflict around it.
It also has probably, I'm guessing, a lot to do with the time of your life that you get into a relationship. It's one thing to get together with someone in your 20s. You're both kind of broke. You're figuring it out together. You grow together versus maybe coming into a relationship when you're an established adult. You've got your patterns and then you're suddenly negotiating that with a whole different person.
Yeah, well, there's lots of ways to look at it. Like firstly, when you're young and when you first team up with someone, if the spending habits are incongruent, it can often be perceived as quite novel. It's like, oh, great, I'm with someone that really enjoys, you know, living life to the full. This is good for me. It loosens the reins for me. And also those that overspend might go, oh, I love the steadying effect that this person's having on me. And when we're young, we don't mind being a bit flexible. But as the bills mount, when we get older and we start to have to think more responsibly, those incongruencies, whether they're big or small, if they're not discussed, they can form quite a wedge and lead to a lot of resentment in a relationship.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with our resident psychologist, Christine Bagley-Jones. We're talking about having the money chat with your partner. I wonder if you've found some strategies to figure out how to talk about where you spend your money. Pretty hectic story coming through on the text line, Christine. This person says, my husband suddenly died, leaving me over $1 million in debt for business and personal mortgage expenses. A year before he died, I figured this debt amount. We had a huge row and he very reluctantly agreed to life insurance. Without the insurance, I would have lost everything we'd spent 30 years working for. Even so, the insurance company refused to pay out for 8 months. So when do you have these conversations, I suppose, is what follows from that.
I mean, that example, Tegan, is a testimony to the importance of transparency and open communication. It would be the single most important thing to do in a relationship where you're trying to build trust. So as soon as you believe this person could be your person, because you don't want to do it with every person you're dating, but once it starts to feel a bit more serious, have those difficult conversations early. There's a lot of key conversations that you have early, and money would have to be one of them, where you both commit to wanting to understand each other's patterns of spending without judgment, but in fact with curiosity. Like, where did that come from? Or why does it matter so much that you get to spend money on A, B, or C, or you don't spend that money? And then find a way to be on the same page. Like, work together at meeting each other's needs respectfully, but also don't be in the dark, because that's a shock. And it's very fortunate that the insurance that this woman got did happen in the final hours, because imagine the alternative. So it's really important not to be naive around your finances, because life does offer lots of twists and turns.
What, like, give me a script. How do you initiate that conversation? What sort of questions should you be trying to draw out?
I think maybe start with a bit of curiosity, but also be a bit playful. Start with some self-disclosure, like share, oh, look, this is, I've got a pension for spending money on shoes or whatever it might be, and invite your partner to have a conversation, reassuring them that this is more about fact-finding rather than judgment, and we won't make any hard and fast rules. We'll always be working together. So you just start by saying, hey, we're feeling like, you know, this is possibly something that's going to lead to a more permanent relationship. How exciting. Let's start making the foundations really solid by, you know, turning a few stones so that we understand who we deeply are.
What about joining finances? I think legally there's probably some joining that occurs, but some people have separate bank accounts. Some people put it all into one big pot. Is there a right or wrong way to do this?
Well, I definitely do see the variety of the way people do business regarding money, and there is no right or wrong way. The rule of thumb, if you're weirdly on the same page, then you could join finances, and conversely, if you're completely not willing to come to the party and you both want to stay very much in your money lane, then you could have separate finances. But to me, the hybrid is the sweet spot where you have a joint account where all of the bills come out of that are mutual and all the expenditure that's mutual, but you have your own private accounts. And there's a lot of value to that. It's about autonomy for a start. And it's also just about, like, you know, if you want to buy someone a gift, or, you know, there's that romantic element to it. And just that frivolous ability to be able to say, I want to spend this and I don't want to explain it. So managing your own money is good as well. And also it's just nice to have those separate bank accounts just to watch how they go, so you still remain responsible.
So I feel like whenever we're approaching this conversation, my default setting is that I'm right and the other person's in the wrong. What if I'm the problem? How do I unlearn some of those bad habits?
Well, I think it's really great if you can identify it for a start, because that's one of the biggest barriers to making change, is being in denial about it. So if you're actually saying, Tegan, look, I might be the one that's overspending or underspending and not enjoying life enough, there are both sides to this, then yielding to the idea of change and being open to it, and don't just take your partner's cue, go do your own research and, I guess, learn what feels right for you in accordance to your values, your sense of security and needs, and what a good life looks like. Don't just carry on what you've inherited by your family of origin, and don't be overly swayed just by your partner's narrative. Figure out what you want to do and then start making inroads. There's heaps of resources about it. And it's about a bit of discipline too. You might have to set yourself some systems in place to curb spending and create a more formalized budget.
Christine, thank you so much as always for chatting with me today. Christine Begley-Jones is our resident psychologist. She joins me fortnightly for Head and Heart. And thank you for your texts too. One says, I'm dating in my 60s and financial intimacy is something that's really important. Another, my wife and I had free will spending until we had kids. When her income dropped significantly, I had to shift my spending habits. The best solution we found is joint income and expenditure accounts with an equal weekly transfer to our personal accounts to spend as we wish. It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. What's your religion? You flooded me with your stories about how you're answering this question on the census. Social trends researcher Rebecca Huntley explained earlier why this question of religion is so important to capture in the census.
Once upon a time, religion would have been extraordinarily important, you know, again, to understand who Australia is. I mean, I'm interested in all the other questions that you would have in the census. There are very obvious planning implications from that in terms of how we plan our economy, how we plan our cities, how we plan healthcare, education, and so forth. It's interesting to see whether religion is something, and I wouldn't know because I'm not a politician or a bureaucrat, whether those kinds of things are really playing into the kinds of decisions about, you know, whether particular kinds of religious infrastructures or churches need to be built in some areas or not. I'm not sure what it does, if it has the same kinds of implications as other kinds of questions in the census. I think we will know, you know, it will be very interesting the moment that no religion overtakes established religion, if that happens in this census or the next one. That's where the trend is going, and what that might mean for our politics and for our decision making. I'm really interested to see what happens.
That's Rebecca Huntley talking to me earlier in the show about census, and you were sharing your stories as well. One says, I was born to an angry atheist father. Then I married an Anglican priest. Imagine, was immersed in the church on a daily basis, attending church, working voluntarily for the church, living in church houses for 30 years. My priest husband's infidelity with many of my friends, both in the church and out, over the course of that time, finally put an end to my religion. I now put no religion. Well, that is it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. I'll be back again tomorrow talking about the fact that we love to whinge about how badly we slept last night, or track our sleep stats to see if we can optimise our sleep. Well, tomorrow, insights from an evolutionary biologist that will turn what you think you know about sleep on its head, including the fact that among our fellow apes, we barely sleep at all. That's tomorrow on Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.